This is going to be another fascinating walk through relatively recent history. We're going to take a look back at World War II and some of the extraordinary things that occurred on both sides of the picket fence, so to speak, but especially that which occurred with the German U-boat corps. The incredible losses that were absorbed by these men who went down with their ships by the thousands and thousands. Certainly we're not demeaning or ignoring the damage those ships caused, but it was war. And in war, people do things that they ordinarily wouldn't be doing. But to help bring this forward, I've invited Harry Cooper back to talk about this amazing war in which there were no televisions, no touch-tone telephones, no cell phones, no computers. They were just men and amazing machines. And if you go to the website sharkhunters.com, you'll find a wealth of material there, pictures, videos, books, just all kinds of things. It is a website that is dedicated to German U-boat history, in-depth stories by U-boat skippers, those relatively few who survived, the history of the boats themselves. And we're going to look at a lot of very interesting pictures tonight, which you can find right under Harry Cooper's name in the guest section at my homepage, Rentz.com. Harry, are you there? Welcome back.
Well, good to be back, Jeff.
Thanks for sending all those pictures, and to James for getting them put up on pages for the program.
I hope I didn't overwhelm him.
No, he was able to get it done, and they're extraordinary. Let's go back, in case folks don't remember your first visit, and just give some of the basic parameters, some of the statistics of how many U-boats there were approximately produced during the war. Actually, we know pretty well exactly. How many men were in the U-boat corps and the losses that they suffered. And as you said, even at the end of the war, when the war was lost, they were still lined up around the block practically trying to enlist in the U-boat services.
Yeah, that's correct. That was the most oversubscribed service. And, of course, it was the smallest in number of men. They had a total of approximately 39,000 signed up, and only about 6,000 or 7,000 came home. So they lost about 6 men out of every 7.
That's the highest attrition rate has to be of any service or any part of any service that I can imagine.
Right, the highest ever in history. And when I first heard about the U-boats, that was back 1980, 1981, I was a yacht bum living on my boat in the Bahamas, and I ran across this island where they said the landowner was providing fresh water and food to the U-boats. And of course, my first thought was those dirty Nazis, because that's the way we were taught.
Of course.
And then when I finally came back home to the real world, I started to research. That was in 1982. And I found that this was indeed the worst attrition rate of any military force ever in history, and they were not the godless Nazis that we were told. I was a kid during the war years, and they didn't machine gun helpless men in the water for sport. They didn't pray to Hitler, and they were very honorable, decent people. They'd surface and try to help the guys in the lifeboats after they sank the ship, and I felt that people that were this brave really deserve to have their history told honestly. And we're not embellishing anything. We're just telling the honest history. And
right.
That's something you don't get in school so much anymore.
Right. And again, we're not ignoring our side, so to speak, in the war, because our side owns history. And they get plenty of recognition and always have. And that's the way it works. That's the winners write the story. And the country of origin writes its own history about its military and its exploits.
Right, and when it's all said and done, all the war heroes were on our side, all the war criminals were on their side. Funny
That's
how
right.
things sort out that way,
yeah,
isn't
yeah.
it?
It's the same old,
our,
same
our
old.
Guys were fantastic, too. There's no question about that. But you can go to any library anywhere and find a zillion books on the American side, and that's great, rightfully so. But if you start trying to research the German side right away, you know, people think... you're a Nazi, anti-American, and that's not the case. It's just we're historians.
Right. Well, very few people in the German military were actually members of the party anyhow. People
right.
don't get
in
that.
In the Navy, in the U-boats, they were not allowed to belong to any party.
This is a patriotic war that had its roots in the outrageous Treaty of Versailles, which was forced on Germany after World War I, which guaranteed World War II. No country is going to live under that kind of subjugation. It was just incredible.
Right.
So what we have is history repeating, but history repeating by design. And that's the part that people just don't get. And as a culture, and as you pointed out, and as many of you listening well know, some of you listening served in World War II. It's always about the dirty Nazi. Everybody in a German uniform was a dirty, Hitler-loving Nazi. And that just is not the case. There were a lot of Germans who did not like Hitler at all. The real enemy of World War II, if you were to ask, if we had General George S. Patton on the program with us tonight, the real enemy in World War II, he would say, without one nanosecond of hesitation, was Stalin and the Bolshevik, communist, Zionist hordes of Eastern Europe, who accounted for somewhere between 50 and 70,000 or 70 million dead. We don't even know. The accounts of the numbers of dead are in the thousands, but it's well over 50 million, and Patton knew it. And after the Germans ceased hostilities, and over a million of them prepared to be liquidated, executed, genocided by Eisenhower in these open-air barbed wire enclosures, after that happened, Patton was actually organizing and had several SS divisions together. He wanted to go into Eastern Europe and push the Russians, the Soviets, the Bolsheviks, all the way back to Moscow. He wanted to kick them out. He knew what was coming, and that's why they killed him.
No question about that. No question. When I was still a neophyte with this history, you know, you read the story, Patton got killed in a car wreck, head-on car wreck. Okay, you get the mental image, bang, bang, bent car.
Massive smash, you know, 70 miles an hour. No, yeah. Wasn't that way at all.
And you get the mental image of dead Patton in the back seat of the car, but no, he lived for, what, another week in the hospital?
Yeah.
And from what I understand, he was getting better.
Yep, they killed him in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very easy to do.
yeah, he's kind of captive there.
At one point, somebody came forward, a former OSS asset, at least that's what he claimed, and he said he was the man who had actually been involved with the assassination in the hospital. Can't remember the guy's name. I was in one of those magazines. It's a news magazine. It was on newspaper print stock. Can't remember the name. The Outlook? No. What was that?
I don't know. There were a lot of them.
Anyway, there were a bunch of them. But it was quite an interesting story, and I actually did save it for a while.
His biggest problem also was not only wanting to march east, but he kept asking embarrassing questions like what happened to the $2 billion worth of gold that disappeared out of the Reichsbank after the Allies overran Berlin.
The same thing. When the Soviet Union was taken down, something, hundreds of tons of gold vanished. They looted it. There's nothing new, folks.
Yeah.
And all of the alleged Nazi treasures and hoards that were collected by the Germans during the war, believe me, most of that was not returned to its rightful owners. It was, in many cases, brought over here, or
yeah,
brought to England, or brought to Russia. It was stolen. It's looters upon looters upon looters. What was it just the other day, 2 days ago, Angela Merkel was under fire in the German Zionist-dominated press for having a Persian rug or an Oriental carpet in her office that had belonged to Goebbels.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's quite an amusing story. The UK press doesn't miss a beat. Not a week goes by when they don't drag out an evil Nazi story or two, it seems. It's the same old thing.
It keeps the cash registers ringing
in certain
parts of the Middle East.
Right. All right. Now, the idea of submarines goes back to World War I. Did the Germans pioneer the submarine? We had them in the Civil War, all right, in very crude configurations, but
right,
modern submarines really were the domain of German engineers and scientists, correct?
Yeah, Germany pretty well wrote the book on submarine warfare, submarine engineering and design. The U.S. Navy copied it pretty well, and now that the German Navy has no big submarines. The U.S. Navy pretty well writes the book on it there. But if it hadn't been for the German Navy in the First World War, the Kaiserliche Marine, where would submarine warfare be? I don't know.
Well,
we see U-1 from World War One when we go. We take history groups over there to Germany, and mm-hmm. we meet with a lot of the veterans, not only the U-boats, but also Waffen-SS, Flyboys, et cetera, et cetera. But we go into the Deutsches Museum in Munich, and U-1 of World War One is in there. That submarine is in there.
Oh, that's hard to believe.
And
wow.
You got to wonder, how the hell ever got anybody to get into those things? They just look like they look like death traps.
Huh.
But the Germans used them to great advantage, and a World War One skipper was the most successful submarine commander ever in history, a guy named Lothar von Arnold de la Perrier, and he sank 198 ships. He's a busy guy.
That's astonishing.
Yeah.
That's just amazing.
Most of them were with the deck gun, because back in those days, most ships did not have shortwave radio, and he would just get into the steamer lanes and flood down and sit there at periscope depth, and a steamer would come lumbering along, and he'd pop up and tell him, okay, stop. All you guys get in the lifeboat and get out of the way, because we're going to sink your ship. Most of the time, he did not send the ship down with people on it. But in those days, you could get away with that because there was no shortwave radio. Come
yeah.
World War II, as soon as they got hit, they'd be on the radio with the SSS was the radio call. Dot, 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 dot.
Mm-hmm.
Means we've been attacked by submarine, and then mm-hmm. they give their position, and before long, the anti-submarine guys were out there. So they didn't have that luxury after World War II
right.
went
right.
on for a little while.
Okay, hold on a second, Harry. We have to take a little break. We'll do that. Come right back with Harry Cooper of Shark Hunters. Talking with Harry Cooper of Shark Hunters. Just click on Harry's name. You go right to the site, just sharkhunters.com. It's all there. Lots of information. Interesting note on President Reagan. President Ronald Reagan
yep.
was a Shark Hunters member from 1991 until his death in 2004.
Right. And I'm looking at a framed photo and a letter that he sent me way back when. It's hanging on my wall. That was the first letter I got from him, but we corresponded a little bit. Great president, great man.
Very, very personable fellow. I had a chance to spend a little time with him, and I guess the easiest way to describe him was really a nice guy.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
All right. Well, we have put together, thanks to Harry, a whole lot of photos, which I think we're going to start going through now. And would you like to start with the U-boat captains or the U-boat photos? We've got photos 1 and 2 and U-boat captains. We can go back and forth, whatever you like.
whatever you like. My computer is coming up a little slowly, but we're getting to it. Incidentally, if I may pitch out this thought, let your listeners know, please, that if they send us an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net, we'll send them a sample copy of our magazine, which goes electronically to our members. Monthly magazine, it's actually 10 times a year.
Very nice. All right, so all you got to do is send an email to sharkhunters@earthlink.net, sharkhunters@earthlink.net, and ask for the free sample of their monthly magazine. It'll be electronically sent to you.
That's correct. And then if they like, we also send out what I call a hot mail, usually once a day, with more or less the headlines of the submarine news, the U-boat history news. The details are in our magazine. The details also go to our members, but even if a person is not a member, they still get the hot mail with the headlines, if they like. It's
very good. Well, I appreciate the offer, and I'm sure many people will take you up on that.
Okay.
Sharkhunters@earthlink.net, and just say, hi, Harry, please send me a complimentary copy of your monthly magazine.
That's
electronic.
It. That's all. It, and they'll get it right back.
All right. Let's go to We've got so many U-boat photos. We'll start with U-boat photos one.
Okay.
And if you can pull those up and guide us through this. If not, I'll do my best to describe what we're looking at. Maybe the picture will come through here.
It's opening up. I've got an old computer here. We got a whole bunch of computers, but the older computer, which is XP, that's the one I use for my headline. Okay.
I think also we should mention Das Boot, the video. I'm actually surprised that that film was able to be made.
Yeah.
It was a very honest film, extraordinary and kind of unforgettable.
Right. People who have seen it, which is just about everybody who's halfway interested, basically they say when it comes to submarine films, there's Das Boot, and then there's all the rest.
That's it. Agreed. Yeah.
It was outstanding, and the skipper who was portrayed in that film, the guy who got machine gunned at the end of the picture in real life, did not get killed. His name was Heinrich Lehmann Willenbrock, and he was a member of Shark Hunters until his death.
Why they have to do that? I guess for dramatic impact, or
I guess. Well, sure the same as in that dumb movie U-571, which was so totally farcical, they had to have extra stuff, otherwise it would have been boring. The real submarine that got captured was U-110, captured by the Brits before the United States was even in the war, and the radio operator on that boat is still alive today. He's a good friend of mine. He lives in Munich, and they were towing the boat back to one of the British ports when suddenly somebody realized, hey, if we tow this submarine in, German observers are going to see that they captured the boat and figure we've got the codes and the Enigma machine. So it suddenly just foundered under tow and went down. Amazing how that happened.
Yeah. Well, okay. All right. Our first photo is a daylight photo looking at the bridge or the conning tower. What do we call that?
The conning tower is the whole structure. The bridge is the area up at the top where the officers are standing.
Okay. All right.
And this is an early version because you can see he's got a deck gun. After about 1943, there were no deck guns on the boats because they couldn't stay surface long enough to use them.
Because of the danger of being sunk. And you talked last time about the almost instant triangulation when the submarines would use their... You talk about the radio operator, they'd have a burst, a very short burst. That short burst was just enough to give the other side, the so-called allies, an opportunity to triangulate where they were, and they'd have planes and ships headed that way, I guess, within minutes.
Right. They call it the Kurtz signal. Kurtz signal means brief signal. And they thought they could send it off so quickly that nobody could triangulate them in the standard manner of rotating a loop antenna, and they were right there, but they didn't know about Huffduff, the high-frequency direction finder.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't matter how fast he was. The instant he hit the key the first time, he was triangulated. And depending on where he was, he either had bombers over him or he had destroyers heading his way, and it generally was the end. Some of the U-boaters told me that their skippers and that's why they're still alive. Their skippers did not believe in long, drawn-out conversations on the air. Some of them, like Otto Kretschmer, who was sunk before the U.S. was in the war, he wouldn't even reply when Carl Dönitz's headquarters demanded that he answer. And Otto told me later that he got back, and Captain Dönitz at the time chewed him out. He says, aren't you supposed to answer my... obey my orders and answer my radio messages. And Otto said, yeah, my first duty is to bring my ship back. And he said, I know that they can find us if I'm on the radio.
They knew.
Yeah.
Do you think he knew that even the short bursts, which were used later on, were enough to doom them?
Not the short bursts at that time. Remember, Otto Kretschmer was out of the war on St. Patrick's Day, 1941. That was 8 months before the U.S. even got into the war.
Yeah. Yeah.
And two or three years before Huffduff came into being. But even so, you know, they'd get two, three, 4 minutes long on the radio, and that was plenty to get caught.
Got it. Okay. All right. We'll take a look at more pictures as we come back in a couple minutes with Harry. And the next picture shows 30 and 32 boats with deck guns. Yep. And there's another one to the right of that one. We'll talk about those and many more pictures. Some of these pictures are absolutely fascinating. You'll see what I mean as we get through them. Back in just a minute. Okay, I'm back with Harry Cooper, Shark Hunters.
Good morning, good afternoon, whatever it is here.
Yeah, good day. And all right, our second picture shows U-30 and U-32, and another one coming up in the background, and another one on the right. What are we looking at here?
Right, you can tell that these are pre-war because they've got the number on the conning tower. Once the war started, there were no numbers on the conning tower because at that time, Carl Dönitz didn't want the enemy, the Brits at that time, to know which boat was where. So, so they took off the numbers, but yet they were allowed to put up any particular conning tower design they wanted. So instead of seeing U-30, they saw a boat with a dog painted on the tower. U-30 there, incidentally, was the first boat into war. It fired the first torpedo and blew up a rock. They thought it was a cruiser. They sank the first ship, the liner Athenia, and they were the first boat into a captured American port. And the radio operator on that boat, who's still a member of Shark Hunters and a good friend of mine, he went over to U-110, which we were just talking about, which was the basis of the movie U-571.
Hmm. Right.
So those are both Type 7As. That was the first of the Type 7 or the so-called Wolfpack U-boats. There were only 10 made, only five of them of that particular variant. Only five of them were alive until like a year and a half into the war. The other five were sunk.
Hmm. Okay, the next picture has a little red arrow pointed to a logo on a conning tower.
Right, that's the characterized little dog, and that boat is U-30. And the guy with the white hat is Fritz Julius Lemp, the skipper of U-30. And after it was in combat for a while, they took it out of combat service, made it a training boat, and that's when he and his crew took over U-110.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the white cap, incidentally, the skippers all wore it, allegedly, so that the crew knew who the commander was at night. Believe me, they knew who the skipper was. They were in awe of their skippers always. It was not issue, and that's why you never see Otto Kretschmer with a white cap.
Hmm.
He was a Prussian officer. He said it wasn't issue. He wasn't going to have it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The logos were also seen on a lot of the Luftwaffe aircraft. Adolf Galland was a big fan of Mickey Mouse.
Right.
He had a picture of Mickey Mouse on the side of his Messerschmitt.
Right, with a six gun in his hand, if I remember.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, Galland was also a member of Shark Hunters.
Oh, good, yeah. I was able to actually send him a couple of videotapes of early Disney 1930s Mickey Mouse cartoons. And,
oh, yeah.
His wife wrote me a very nice letter. He just loved them.
Yeah, she was a nice lady.
Yeah.
He's gone, you know. He died on the operating table.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Our next picture shows a boat at sea.
That's U-30 again during sea trial.
Uh-huh. Crew is a number of men are up on top.
Right, by the deck gun. And they're not going very fast. You can see by the wake. They're probably making 8 to 10 knots there.
Uh-huh. And the picture below that shows two. And then three, if you look closely, U-boats. One is painted white, or what appears to be white, and then the middle one is a darker color, and the other is a kind of a middle gray. Did they vary in colors much?
Yeah, in the early stages, yeah, but after a while, then they were mostly deck gray with the, what do you call that, the red, we would call it primer paint, red anti-fouling below the waterline.
Uh-huh.
That's U-30 closest to the dock. And
I see.
U-28.
U-30, 28, yeah. And
yeah, because our friend George there, who was the radio operator, he sent us a ton of photos.
Was the device on the bow of these boats designed to core a hull, open a hull? Is that what that's for? What is
for? That's a net cutter. That's a net cutter.
Ah, very good. I knew it cut something. I didn't know
that's a net cutter. But those were only on the early ones, and they were a throwback to the World War I days. And I don't know of any U-boats that actually cut through a net with those. And another one of the boats belonging to a friend of ours who's now dead, Herbert Zoller, he got caught in an anti-submarine net in the Soviet Union. It was at the entrance to Kola Fjord. They were going to go in and sink a battleship in there, and in the meantime, he got stuck in the net, and they had to fight with it all night long and got out just before daylight and got back to the base.
That's a lot of work. Wow.
Yeah, and he's very fortunate that all the bouncing and tugging didn't raise the alarm with the Soviets, because, you know, if you're caught in that, they'll just send out somebody to drop a depth charge on you, and that's the end of the ball game.
Wow. All right, the next is a watercolor or a painting of some kind showing a freighter in flames and the U-boat cruising a couple hundred yards away, and they're watching the lifeboats be lowered on the port side anyway.
Right. That's a painting of, now we're moving into the pictures I got from Eric Topp, the commander of U-552, and that's his boat there, all rust-streaked, that has sunk that freighter. And they usually stood by in the early stages of the war. They stood by to make sure the guys got into the lifeboats, and then once the target vessel went down, they would ask if they needed any medical help or give them water. And
this is something that we never hear about over here, of course.
No, you always hear that they machine gun people in the water for sport, and that just never happened. There was only one instance where a U-boat machine gunned people in the water. And that was when Heinz Eck, commander of U-852, sank a ship in the South Atlantic. He was not supposed to sink anything until he got into the Indian Ocean. But this was his first patrol, and he didn't realize how much stuff was floating after a ship sank. And this was the middle of the night, and he realized that once the patrol planes came out in the morning, they would see all the debris and know there was a submarine in the area, and they'd come after him. So he was firing on the crates and everything floating, and some of the survivors said that they were hiding on the backside of the crates because they were told, this was wartime propaganda, they were told that the Germans would machine gun them. So they were hiding on the backside, and the bullets were coming through, and some of the people got hit. He was sunk in late 1944 off the Somali coast. And he was captured. He and his whole crew were captured. They knew who he was, but they didn't let on that they knew. And then as soon as the war was over and the British prisoners were released from German captivity and there could be no retaliation, then they brought this guy up on court-martial charges for sinking that ship and killing those people. And this was, about September of 45. The war had been over for about 6 months. And they told him, if you swear in court that Admiral Dönitz gave the order to machine gun people in the water, then you're off the hook and you'll live. Well, he knew that they were just going to use him to put a noose around Dönitz's neck, and Admiral Dönitz never did give such an order. As a matter of fact, one time Hitler told Dönitz to issue such an order to his men, and Dönitz refused. He says, no, people in the water, we help them. So he declined, and they found him guilty, surprise, and he was shot by firing squad in December of 1945. I spent a whole day with his sister, and she gave me a huge pile of documents, all the court documents from his kangaroo court there.
Well, those Nuremberg trials were, I don't even want to go there. It's just...
Well, they weren't really called trials. They were called tribunals.
Exactly. And they were just formatted execution protocols is all they were for many people.
And we have since learned that these men were not sentenced to hang, because we hear every so often that they thought maybe the hangman wasn't good at his job, and the man hung there. They didn't drop him through the trap and snap his neck like normally. They just hanged him and let him strangle like in the old Wild West. And last year when we were there, we looked at some of the documents, and these guys were sentenced to death, not by hanging, but by strangulation. And so they were had a rope around their neck and just hung on a hook, more or less. And they'd thrash around, and it must have been a horrible way to die.
So much for the great moral allied victory.
Yeah, it looks good on paper, but you know, we've got a wonderful country here, but there are some things that were done that were not. I wouldn't be proud of them.
We're not. Those of us who know about them are not. I'm not proud of the Allies in many ways. Bomber Harris, the man's name should live in infamy.
Well, he's probably in hell right now playing cards with Eisenhower, Roosevelt, Churchill, Stalin.
Yeah, that's where they all belong.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to go right through the break here. Next picture is three men on a top of a conning tower, apparently on patrol, always looking, always looking.
Right, that's U-552 again, and you'll notice they've got the 20-millimeter gun right there, or they call it the 2.0 centimeter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you see that on the right of the the picture. But yeah, these are the lookouts. They did not have the fancy lookout structure like we had on the American boats, where they had a platform more or less up in the periscope shears, where the guys could stand like 15, 20 feet up above.
Much better view. Yeah.
Right. These guys were just standing on the bridge, looking around. And the guy on the left, I don't know if he's got binoculars. It might be a sextant. Kind of hard to see.
Interesting. Yeah, it is. Okay, next picture below that is a small picture. That's looks like it was painted white or something very light gray.
Right, and it was light tan. That was also U-552 in earlier days. And you notice the conning tower emblem, the two dancing red devils.
Yeah.
That was Eric Topp's boat again, and they called his the Red Devil boat. And in one of the CDs we have, which was an interview with Top, he said our conning tower emblem was the two dancing red devils, one what we had to do and one what we wanted to do. One was the devil of death. We had to sink ships. The other was devil of life. We wanted to return home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Next is a watercolor of part of the crew on deck.
Right, that's U-552 again.
Uh-huh. There's the Red Devil. I can see it.
Yep. He was a nice guy. He wound up back into the German Navy, and he retired at the at the rank of Counter Admiral, which is a two-star.
All right. Okay, next picture. A white-hatted captain on the left and someone in a brown or black cap on the right.
Right, the white cap, that's Eric Topp, commander of U-552.
Uh-huh.
Incidentally, he was the third most successful submarine commander of any nation in World War II. He sank 36 ships.
Hmm.
And he was one of only five guys to be in the U-boats. He was one of only five guys to receive the Knight's Cross with oak leaf and crossed swords. Only five guys in the U-boats got that.
Wow.
Out of, like, over 1,000 captains.
They all had beards.
Oh, yeah. They on the way home, they liked to look rough and ready, but also they didn't have very much fresh water on the boat. They had fresh water tanks, but mostly that was for cooking, and their desalinator could make just about enough to replenish what the batteries were using.
So, again, the white cap was something that the captains just started doing on their own.
Right. It was a leftover from World War One.
Uh-huh.
And it was an unofficial badge of rank.
Got it. Well, they deserve it. Okay.
Oh, yeah, why not?
Next picture, flags strung from above, and the boat obviously coming in to port, I would say. Happy face on the right there.
That's correct. And the guy in the conning tower with the white cap, that's Eric Topp again.
Topp again, yeah.
And the flags, officially, they were called tonnage pennants.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just scraps of cloth that the guys made on board the submarine, and they would put a number like 5,000 or 6,000. Each one represented a ship that was sunk. And the U-boaters call them the bragging flags. And you'll notice by those flags, Topp sank a whole bunch of ships on that patrol.
Yeah.
All right. Judging by the backdrop, I'd say they were coming into Hamburg on that. And you'll see down on the lower part of that photo, the storming bull or the rampaging bull, whatever, that was the conning tower emblem on Gunter Preen's boat, U-47. He's the guy that snuck into the British home fleet anchorage and sank the battleship Royal Oak. And that emblem was on his conning tower. So the commander of the 7th U-boat flotilla, after Preen was killed on 7 March 1941, the commander of that 7th flotilla, which was based at Saint-Nazaire, ordered that all the boats in his flotilla must have that that bull on there, in addition to anything else they painted, but they had to have the bull.
All right, and then there's an enlargement of that photo.
Same photo.
Then we go down again, and there's the Red Devils and some of the crew standing.
Right,
The color of this boat, again, would be?
A gray or a...
Light gray?
Yeah, light gray.
Mm-hmm.
And the Red Devils, they were in red, of course. And judging from, like I say, the background, this was in Hamburg, so they were probably coming in for repairs because they were actually based at Saint-Nazaire on the Brittany coast of France. But this is obviously Hamburg, so they were probably coming into Blumenvoss or one of the other shipyards for some kind of repairs.
Yeah, next photo shows a lot of flowers on the bridge.
Right. They had just been received by all the girls and the band. And
Captain Top up there.
That's correct. Yeah, he's got his back to us, and he's turned around looking over his right shoulder. At this point, his rank was Capitaine Lieutenant, which was 2.5 rings, which is the same as our Lieutenant Commander.
All right. Next one is an interesting action shot of a boat on patrol and a little bit of weather.
Right, that's U-552 again.
Uh-huh.
And the guy in his slicker, his oil cloth there, because they had a lot of spray. These things were running about 18 knots, and as you can see in the picture, they had spray going every which way.
Did they pitch up and down?
Well, if the weather was that
fairly,
way, sure.
Did they, generally speaking, would they be able to stay relatively stable in a forward motion?
Well, it wouldn't roll quite so much, but if there was any kind of sea activity, they'd be pitching, because these things were only 220 feet long, roughly.
Yeah.
And depending on which variant of the Type 7, this one you're looking at is a Type 7C, which was the most widely produced submarine of anybody ever in the world ever.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I believe, 760 tons. And so when you're pushing it at about 18 knots, if you've got a heavy sea, of course, you're going to have spray flying every which way.
Yeah. All right, the next one shows the bull.
Yeah.
And 1008 on the front, and a massive dent in the top of the bridge.
Yeah, that's Eric Top again. And the 1008, there's actually a couple more numbers around the other side. That was how many tons?
Tonnage?
For that particular patrol.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a very famous battle. The Germans didn't have anything worth anything in the way of radar detection. And so he was in a heavy fog, and a Canadian corvette, HMCS Sackville, had him on the radar. And they had no way of knowing until suddenly this Canadian corvette showed up 100 yards off, making pretty fast speed.
Huh.
And that's how he got his conning tower all crushed. And they just shot the heck out of these guys. But fortunately for Top, they didn't start firing until they were too close, and they couldn't depress the guns enough to get them because the submarine was way low. And,
so the deck guns, the angle of fire was too high, and that saved him. Wow.
Right. And he got hit, and that's why he's in Hamburg getting his conning tower repaired.
That's a shell that hit the tower?
No, that was the bow of the corvette.
You're kidding.
No, he was diving when the corvette got there.
Right under them. Wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That happened quite frequently. And a lot of times, though, when they get rammed, if they were running submerged,
mm-hmm.
they just never came up because it busted open the hull and the boat went down.
Right. Can't even imagine something that horrible. The last picture in this first set shows these are Type 7s. There's the Red Devil.
Right.
Emblem. And above, four what appear to be Condors.
That's correct. Focke Wulf 200 Condors.
Now, that was an interesting aircraft. It was, as I recall, troubled with a lot of design errors and flaws, and the tail would break off on takeoff occasionally, causing a catastrophic wreck. But that was the first big four-engine long-distance reconnaissance, and I guess it was able to engage in combat, too. It was an observation platform, as well as it did duty and dropped bombs.
Right, and they also used them for passenger work, too. So it was a one-size-fits-all.
Yeah.
But this was kind of
like our DC-4, DC-6s, that kind of a thing.
Right. But this was kind of a fantasy picture. This showed the Condors scouting for the U-boats, which after the first couple months of the war, when Goering said, "No, if it flies, it's mine," that was the end of the recon.
Also, didn't the British somehow take Spitfire or something and catapult launch them to go up and try to shoot these Condors down when they'd encounter them out in the middle of the ocean?
Yeah, in the early stages of the war, before the U.S. even got into it, they would catapult either a Spit or a Hurricane.
No, I was right. That's fascinating.
And they would go out and do whatever they could, but then they'd have to splash the plane and haul the pilot up, and so they had to. The planes were disposable, more or less.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. All right, let's go on to page 2, right at the bottom there. Just click on that, and we'll go ahead with our
tour. These are all the upscale-type submarines.
Now, this is very interesting. Some of the pictures here you're going to see are quite extraordinary. Advanced technologies being now implemented. This has to be 43, 44, I would think.
Late 44.
Late, huh? They were working out.
Yeah, the development of these boats, the Type 21 primarily, was delayed because they didn't realize that Allied technology was overrunning them so quickly. But this submarine was the first true submarine. It had a snorkel that was hydraulically operated and had a much larger snorkel head on it, so they could run submerged. And underwater, they could reach 18 knots, which was incredible for those days. Most submarines, 7 knots, maybe 8 underwater. These guys would do 18 knots underwater.
How many of these type boats were deployed?
They never got them into combat. They got the Type 23, which was the coastal version of this. They got those into combat, and they were incredibly successful because they could penetrate the destroyer screen easily at 18 knots. They'd sink something and be back outside the destroyer screen, and the destroyers would be depth-charging an area where they figured the U-boat should have been at the speed of 7 knots, and yet these guys are 18 knots, and they're long gone.
Wow.
The Type 21s, there were hundreds of them ready to go to sea when the surrender order came. Only one boat got out. That was U-2511 under command of Adalbert Schnee. And he got the surrender order while he was at sea, and they figured, well, okay, fine, but let's see what this will do. And so they saw a British Royal Navy task force, and they dived. They penetrated the destroyer screen without being detected, and they surfaced 100 yards off the side of the British cruiser. And the first the Brits knew that submarine was there was when it surfaced right next to the cruiser.
And they surrendered.
Right. They raised the black flag. There was no white flag. They raised the black flag.
And there were hundreds of these boats
ready to go.
Literally finished and ready to go.
That's correct.
And that would have, hundreds of these boats would obviously have had a major impact on shipping.
Right. It would have prolonged the war. It would not have turned it around. By that time, by late 44, early 45, there was. Mm-hmm. There was no way there was going to be any other kind of outcome. The production mm-hmm. of the United States was just so incredible. Excuse me. You could shoot down 50 planes and we'd build 100 more. You could sink 10 ships and we'd build 20 more. You kill a million people, and the Russians would send in 10 million more. So
that's
there
exactly
was no getting around it. But all the victorious powers, well, the two major victorious powers, the U.S. and the USSR, were tripping all over one another to get all these unfinished boats and the finished boats. Doggone it, we're catching cold here in my house. Because that was the first true submarine. And the Russians used that as a prototype to build their whiskey class. The French built the Daphne class. The Brits and the U.S. built our first post-war submarines based on this boat.
The spoils of war.
Yeah, there's only one left in the whole world of these type. Well, there's only one Type 7 left in the world, and there's only one Type 21 left in the world, and we visit both of those when we take our tours to Germany in September every year.
Very good. Okay. Hold on a second, Harry. We have to take a break here at the top of the hour. We'll look at some more phenomenal pictures with Harry Cooper on sharkhunters.com when we come back in just a few minutes. All right, hour number two, talking with Harry Cooper, sharkhunters.com, the story of the German Navy's U-boat fleets and forces in World War II. Their organization, just an extraordinary site to visit, and I hope you'll ask for the free sample of a monthly newsletter. Just write to them and ask. Harry, give them the address again, please.
It's sharkhunters@earthlink.net, and it's a magazine, not a newsletter. It's a 40-page magazine in full color.
Wow. Wow.
Every month.
Okay. Doesn't get any better than that. And as far as doesn't get any better than that, the men who served and who died and who are gone could not really hope to have a better spokesman or champion of their efforts and their bravery than you. I want to commend you on that, Harry.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This is a remarkable thing you put together. And every year you take a tour.
Right. We take history groups over to Germany. We have two different tours set up for this year. The first year is in Berlin. Mm-hmm. And we visit places that are off limits to almost anybody. Gross Admiral Dönitz, in command of the Navy, had his headquarters in Berlin because the Kriegsmarine had been chased out of France, and he had a facility codenamed Coralie, which means coral, outside of Berlin, and he had a three-level bunker in the ground, and we go in it. There's a big sign that says Eingang verboten, and that means shark hunters are welcome here.
You go. I got it. There, people don't know how much undergrounding was done in Germany during the war. That's a big story in and of itself. I've read a little bit about it.
About four times as much underground as they built above ground.
It's hard to believe. It's true. Now, what Harry said is true. Four times as much underground as what the Allies saw above ground. Most of it's still there.
Yeah, exactly. And as I say, we visit the place at Coralie, and the house that Dönitz lived in, we visit that too, but unfortunately the German government's attitude of World War what? Adolf who?
Yeah.
His house is being vandalized. When we were there a couple of years ago, it was in beautiful shape. People were looking to buy it, but now it's just vandalized. We also go to a magnificent estate that the Kaiser built for his cavalry troops, and then in World War II, it was the headquarters of the 5th Panzers, and we go all through that. We go to the town of Kostrzyn, which is just across the Oder River in Poland. That was some of the heaviest fighting because it was only 40 kilometers from Berlin. Where else do we go? We also go into, Joseph Goebbels had a house built, a beautiful big land house, just outside Berlin, and it also has that sign that says shark hunters are welcome, you know, Eingang verboten. And it's still in remarkably good shape. And when we were there about 4 years ago, the German government was going to auction it off because it had a whole lot of land that went with it and some Soviet-built barracks and et cetera. And then suddenly says somebody realized, wait, some wealthy neo-Nazi might buy it and use it for rallies. So they've taken it off the market, and it's just sitting there going to pieces.
Well, hopefully that'll change maybe in time.
Our other tour goes to South Germany, and we are guests of honor at the Ulrichsberg Memorial, which is on top of Ulrichs Mountain. There's a ruined church and a huge cross, and the veterans meet there every year to honor all those who fell in battle, no matter what uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And there are hundreds and hundreds of veterans who come out to meet us, and you know, we mingle with them. It's not like we're on the other side of the bus or whatever. Everybody mingles. We have lunch on the mountain in an old field kitchen. You know, they set up the tents, and we have bratwurst and beer with hundreds and hundreds of veterans. They're just happy to meet with the Americans, and of course, our guys are happy to meet with them.
Sure. There are probably people on both sides, American and German and British, who understand now that, let me phrase this politically carefully. A good argument could be made that we fought the wrong enemy in World War II.
Yeah, that's true. And when we got together, we had a convention years ago in Key Largo, Florida, and Captain Hess, Hans-Georg Hess, my best friend in Germany, was the youngest Knight's Cross winning skipper. He was barely 21 years old when they gave him command of a combat submarine.
Wow.
At a time when the boats weren't coming back from their first war patrol, he made five and sank ships. Another guy who was with us was Ned Beach, the American submarine commander, who wrote a lot of books, including Run Silent, Run Deep.
I've heard the name, yes, of course.
Right. Yeah. They got to be best buddies.
Well,
two guys who were supposed to be been enemies back in 45.
Yeah.
Now they were best buddies.
Yep. And of the million that Eisenhower slaughtered after hostilities ended, who's to mourn them? All of their colleagues do, I'm sure, and probably a lot of... I read some memoirs of Americans who were forced to guard these boys and older men who were left to die, and they were haunted to the end of their lives with this.
Right. We ran first-person memories of one of these soldiers in one of the books we've just come out with. We've got 11 books already in print, and we've got probably five more coming out this year, all first-person. And one of the chapters in one of the books, I don't remember which one, I think it's U-Boat Volume 5, one of the guards was talking about it. And there are other unpleasant things done. There are 17 German prisoners. Some were U-boaters, some were Waffen-SS. They are buried face down in not consecrated ground outside of Leavenworth. And these guys were executed way after the end of the war because they had a snitch. One of their own men was ratting on them.
Got it.
And I was in the military, and we were sworn that if we were captured, we'd give name, rank, and serial number. That's it. And
that's
if one of our people was a rat, we had to kill him. And that's what these guys did. So they were forced to confess. One guy had a gas mask put on his face, and it was filled with fresh cut onions and garlic.
All right, this occurred in America, folks.
Yeah, at Leavenworth.
Yeah, right. There were a lot of German POWs over here. How many were over here? Do we know? Round numbers?
I don't know, but there were a whole lot of German POWs over here. Because once you get here, how are you going to get home if
you
escape?
Don't go home. I knew one man. In fact, he's still alive. He fought in North Africa.
Oh, yeah.
And a very interesting story. His wife somehow survived the Bolshevik hordes and lived long after the war. They were married. Anyway, another story, another time. All right,
okay.
These photos, the first one in the second group we've talked about, there are four pictured U-250 and the others in the next picture. Those are the advanced model.
Yeah, that's U-250-something. Now, these were conning towers were painted after the war by the Allies. These were boats that had been seized as prize of war. These were the Type 21 boats, sometimes called the Electro boat.
And as you said, there were hundreds and hundreds of them ready to go.
Yep, there were. And we found three of them still in their bunker in Hamburg. This was 1988. in an abandoned bunker that was on the property of a shipyard. So we I asked them if we could have permission to come there and take photos. They wrote back and said, permission is denied, and if we catch you, we'll have you arrested. Well, that's just a wet red flag in front of a bull. And so myself and two other members of Shark Hunters put together kind of like an ops plan, and we snuck in, penetrated their security, got into this old abandoned bunker, and sat up there on the edge as the tide went down. They have a 12-foot tide range there. As the tide went down, it was almost like watching the submarine's surface. And we climbed down and were walking on the deck of one of those Type 21s. We have a DVD of that.
You do? You videoed it?
Yeah, you betcha.
Oh, and what happened to those boats?
Well, the federal government in Germany wanted them gone. And the city government of Hamburg says, hey, it's your problem. You get rid of them. And the federal government says, no, no, it's there. You get rid of them. It was a standoff until finally, now these were scuttled. They weren't floating. They were sitting on the bottom. You can only see them at low tide.
I understand.
Some fella snuck in there way back in the late 1990s, and he slipped and he fell, and you fall about 20, 25 feet before you hit the submarine, and he broke enough bones to where he was incapacitated. The tide came up. He was drowned.
Mm-hmm.
So they made a real push. They filled the whole bunker with sand, entombed the boats, blew up the bunker, paved over it. It is now a container shipping terminal with three boats buried underneath.
The boats are there.
Yep.
Shark hunters would love to get them out, I know.
Yeah, it's a little late now, though.
Yeah.
And one of them, I found out later, belonged to a good friend of mine who commanded U-466, Gerd Tater. And I was having dinner with him back in the 1990s. And I said, hey, we found your submarine, U-3506. He says, yeah, in Bunker Elba 2. I said, yeah, you knew it was there? He says, yeah. I said, why didn't you tell me? And he said, well, you didn't ask me. I said, okay, what else do you need to tell me that I haven't asked?
Yeah, well, all right. We got to move on to our next picture now. Three torpedo tubes visible on the port side of this boat.
Right, that's a Type 21 in the dry dock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they had six tubes forward and no tubes aft.
Remember, these boats, only one saw active service at the end of the war.
Right.
And they were all ready to go. Reminds me of the Heinkel Volksfighter that had the little single jet engine on top. I've got a picture of those in an underground cavern. There were maybe 50 of them being built. So many things were being built.
Yeah, they built a lot of airplanes inside
the
mountains.
They never slowed. Yeah, they actually were producing more jets and Messerschmitt fighters at the end of the war than they were at any other time. It's phenomenal, absolutely unbelievable accomplishment in the face of all that bombing.
They had no fuel left, though.
No. No, no pilots shortage, no fuel.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, next picture is of a boat with the snorkel and writing on it.
That's correct. That's a Type 21 conning tower, and you'll notice those two guys on the bridge, those are British Tommies.
Yeah, I can tell.
Right, and the first one says night periscope, and the second one says the attack periscope, and then on the big arrangement it says ball snorkel. That's the snorkel valve, and down there, the I can hardly read it, it's smudgy, Hohenflau, the FUMO, that is what they call the bed spring radar. But notice how smooth the lines are.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They had hydraulically operated anti-aircraft turrets that were supposed to house 30-millimeter guns, but they couldn't get the 30-millimeter guns ready in time, so they put the 20-millimeters in there.
6 more months, and things would have been drawn out, as you say.
Yeah, it would have been a little more difficult.
Yeah. All right, the next picture is a color picture of a restored craft.
Yep. That's the only Type 21 left in the world, and we visit that every year when we go to Germany. You'll notice there's a line of demarcation, the light gray above and the dark gray below.
Yes.
Where that line is, that's the water line. She is sitting way out of the water line now because they've pulled out all the batteries. They have, like 40, 50 tons of battery. They take that out,
these are electric power, electric boats.
That's correct. And they had a huge amount of battery, triple the battery capacity of a normal submarine of the day.
All right. I'm going to keep moving, go right through the break here. The next picture looks like a heavily damaged or certainly rusted out boat that has been through obvious combat of some kind.
Yeah, that I don't have a story on that one.
Okay. And the next one, two young men looking, Kriegsmarine, looking at the camera.
Right, that was before the war ended. That was a ready-to-go Type 21. If you look at the top, you see that streamlined gun turret with the two 20 millimeters pointing
at
you.
Yes, yes. That's amazing they had so much technology.
They were way ahead. And now, as soon as the war ended, the USSR and the United States suddenly had all that technology. They just scooped it all up.
Yeah, now it's the USSR and the USSA.
Something like that.
Something like that. Okay, U-2513.
That's correct.
Picture.
That is the submarine of Eric Topp. You remember the red double boat?
Yeah.
Well, this was his boat, but you'll notice those are all U.S. Navy sailors on it. When the war ended, two boats, this one, U-2513, and another one, U-3008, came over to the United States. 3008 was used for spare parts. It was cannibalized. U-2513 was based down in Key West, and they used that to train anti-submarine forces, give them ping time, they call it, and the destroyers would try to find them, etc. And Eric Topp used to tell this funny story. Harry Truman, when he was president, spent a lot of time down in Key West. They took him out on this boat, the American crew, and they dived, and they were running at about 100 feet down, and suddenly something went wrong, and all the lights went out in the boat, and when they got the lights back on, maybe 30 seconds later, there was all the Secret Service guys with their guns drawn surrounding the president. They wondered if it was a coup d'etat.
Oh, please.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, our next picture is of a boat, obviously, under construction.
Yeah, that's a Type 23 because it's a lot shorter. That's in dry dock.
Coastal boat?
Yes. Mm-hmm. 250 tons, thereabouts, 25, 24 men crew.
Did they all have twin screws in the back?
Right. All the German boats had twin screws. All the American boats had twin screws at that time, too.
Mm-hmm. All right. Next picture, U-2363.
That's a Type 23 coastal boat.
Okay. They must have worked on these things around the clock. Around the clock.
Oh, they did. They did, and the shipyards in Hamburg were just going constantly.
Wow. Okay, and our next picture is...
the Type 23 in a dry dock.
Uh-huh. All right. Now, below this is another very interesting picture.
Yeah, Jules Verne time here. These were some of the experimental boats, the Type 17 boats. They only made... I think four of them, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
U-7, the numbers escaped me, 798, something like that.
Uh-huh.
These were, the first one's in the water, the second one is in dry dock. And these were made not only to test the new hull shapes, but also the new propulsion. Anybody who studies this has heard about the Walter turbines. And they used hydrogen peroxide, which, you know, is not what your wife uses to bleach her hair or to clean out wounds. That's only 0.5%.
Uh-huh.
Hydrogen peroxide they were using here was like 98%. And it gave these boats incredible speeds for the time, 26 knots underwater. That was flying. But the hydrogen peroxide was unstable, and they kept having explosions.
Mm-hmm.
And after the war... the Brits took a few of these back to England to experiment with that propulsion. One of them was renamed HMS Explorer, but the crew called her HMS Exploder for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm. Was that the same fuel that the comets used? They'd mix two volatile liquids?
I don't think that's what the comet was using. You're talking about the ME-163, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, this was... the hydrogen peroxide provided the oxygen for the diesel engine.
Well, oxygen and the hydrogen to burn. So
exactly.
Interesting mix. All right, the next picture, we got a boat under power.
Underway. That's another one of the Type 17 boats.
Uh-huh.
The sea trial.
Same thing below that.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Then we go into real Jules Verne looking stuff.
All right.
That's U-791.
Yeah, that's an odd one.
Yeah, most of it is underwater now, remember. You're seeing just the superstructure here.
Mm-hmm.
A really weird-looking submarine. And the next picture below that, you'll see that's the same submarine in dry dock. You can see the hull down there underneath. Looks like a giant cigar.
Unreal. Look at the nose on that thing.
Yeah.
Now, this was 43, 44 again, experimental?
That's correct.
Just obviously built for speed.
Right. They had, I don't remember if they had tubes on that one or not. I'd have to go to my files. But these boats were built primarily to test out the hull shapes and the Walter turbines.
Wow.
And the next picture, you see where we've got that circle. That's the part you saw above the water, and the rest was all below the water.
Yeah. Well, talk about, again, advanced technology. They were a year or two or three or more ahead in some ways.
Oh, it was incredible.
Wow. Okay, there's our tour of U-boats. Just amazing things.
That's a drop in the bucket. We could have tied up your webmaster for weeks with
all
the photos we've got. We've got tens of thousands of photos in our file. We have outside of Germany, we have the largest research archive in the world, except for one in Germany.
Now, what amazes me is that these people were being bombed for years, daily, around the clock sometimes, and they were still able to produce the technology and the equipment of war. As I said, they were producing more fighter planes at the end of the war than they were at any other time, but they had no people to fly them and no fuel for them, and it's just amazing. The biggest... there's a documentary out there called How Hitler Lost the War, Three Strategic Blunders. And one of them was his idea that he wanted that Messerschmitt 262 to become a bomber, a Schnell bomber, which was the dumbest thing. He didn't understand what Galland was telling him, that air superiority was the secret. That was the whole thing. These
That's
planes
right.
would have swept the skies. In fact, when they went up, in squadrons in 45, one flight, and they shot down to 20, 30 bombers, heavy bombers.
Right.
Nobody could touch them.
They were about 100 miles an hour faster than the P-51 Mustangs.
Right.
And what was it? Galland said it was like flying through airplanes hanging on strings.
Well, or the angel, what did he say? The wings of angels propelled it, something like that.
Yeah, that was either him or that was Spaeta in his comet, one or the other.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a member of Shark Hunters too, Wolfgang Spaeta, the first guy to fly a rocket fighter.
Huh. All right. Click on U-boat captains, and we'll take a break here, come back and carry on. And during the next half hour, we're going to talk with Harry again about a little bit about South America. And his belief that there were some very unusual things that happened that everybody knew about at the highest levels involving the top people, some of the top people at any rate. All right, we'll be back in a minute with Harry Cooper, SharkHunters.com. All right, let's get right back to our conversation, half an hour to go, with Harry Cooper of SharkHunters.com. And again, their color-illustrated magazine. Once a month, you can have a free issue sent to you electronically. All you have to do is ask sharkhunters@earthlink.net. Just tell Harry you heard him on the program here and you'd like to get a free issue, please, and they'll send you one. Okay, these we're going to look at some of the captains now, the skippers of these boats. And again... six of seven German U-boat crew members never came home.
That's correct.
Six out of seven were lost. All right. These photos are all Corvette Capitan, same as a U.S. Navy commander, Reinhard Hartigan. He was the commander of a coastal boat, U-147, then commanded a long-range type 9B.
And that's correct.
And came to operate off the American coast, the East Coast, in January of 1942 in Operation Paukenschlag.
Yep.
It means drum beat, but not just any drum. It was the rolling of kettle drums as in a Wagnerian opera. Hartigan operated off New York and could see the swimmers on Coney Island with binoculars from his bridge in daylight.
Yep.
Amazing. He sank the first ship in American waters, had two war patrols against the U.S., the second off Florida's East Coast. For his first patrol, he was awarded the Knight's Cross. Only 145 U-boaters were so decorated. For his second patrol, he was awarded the oak leaf to the Knight's Cross. Only 28 U-boat skippers were so decorated in the war. Shark Hunters has 7,700 members. He is still member number 102 and has been a member since 1985. This March, Captain Hartigan will turn 100 years of age. All right. Take us on a picture tour here. There
okay.
He is.
One short little aside. We are asking all our members and anyone else, if they want, send a birthday card here to us at Shark Hunters. We're going to put them all in a large box and send them over to him on his 100th birthday.
Oh, terrific.
He's a fine gentleman.
Yeah.
Okay, the first three across, the one on the left, that was one of the formal photos of him on receipt of his oak leaf to his Knight's Cross with his cap. The one in the middle is the same, only without the cap.
Mm-hmm.
The one on the right, you see him and his two officers. The one on the lower left is Rudolf Hoffmann, his first watch officer. His Navy career ended right after this. He got a bad review and he was stuck on a desk. The guy in the middle, of course, is Hartigan. And the one on the right is Horst von Schroeder, who later commanded U-123, got his Knight's Cross, rejoined the Navy in 1985, and retired at the highest rank of any of the German U-boaters into the Bundesmarine, Vice Admiral, 3 stars.
Wow.
And that was on their return from the first patrol against the United States. They're going into Lorient.
You know who the fellow on the right looks like?
Mm.
A little bit like Errol Flynn.
Oh, okay. He was a nice guy. I've been in his, he's dead now, but I was in his house I don't know how many times, and all of them spoke flawless English.
Yeah.
And just a fine, fine gentleman.
All right. Next picture, color picture.
The color picture on the left, that's Hartigan.
Uh-huh.
I shot that picture myself years ago in the 1990s when he joined us in at one of our conventions over there. And he had just returned from the South Pole. He had spent like a month in a tent at the South Pole just because there was something he had never done.
Just because. Wow.
Yeah. I told him I thought he was nuts. But that's why I live in Florida. The photo on the right, you see by the 2.5 rings on his sleeve, his rank at that time was Kapitän Leutnant.
Uh-huh.
And he is signing the Golden Book in the city of Hamburg. Hamburg? Uh-huh. No, Bremen. Bremen, the Golden
mm-hmm.
Book in Bremen.
Mm-hmm.
The next picture down, he's holding a giant bouquet of flowers. The guy on the left is a full commander or Corvette Kapitän. He had just been received in Bremen, and he's wearing his new Knight's Cross with oak leaf at his throat there.
Mm-hmm.
The next one down, again, he's with the Golden Book of Bremen, and he's got his U-boat war badge. And you'll notice he's got a pilot's badge also. He started out as a flyboy.
Hmm.
Yeah, more than 100 U-boat commanders started their career as flyers, but then Goering came along and said, if it flies, it's mine, so mm-hmm. the Navy had no more air arm, and they all went over to the U-boats.
That is not Harry Truman on the left. All right.
No, that's not Harry Truman. That's some guy in Bremen. And the next one down, the large picture, that's him again with his Knight's Cross and oak leaf. The U-boat skippers were treated as, you know, like rock stars back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
I'll t- tell you a story about Eric Toppin, the rock star status, in a little while when we get to him. Next one down is Hardagen, very skinny, sporting a beard and his crushed white cap. He only had his Knight's Cross at that time. This is when he returned from his second war patrol. This is before they gave him the oak leaf. Looks happy.
How do you maintain an attitude when 90% of your colleagues are dying? It's just amazing.
At that point in the war,
they weren't.
It wasn't that bad. This was during the so-called happy time, which was really a propaganda company invention. There was no such thing as a happy time. Otto Kretschmer hated that term because they were still losing a lot of people.
Yeah.
But nothing like after Black May of 43.
Right.
And Hardagen operated against America both patrols in 42, so he had it fairly easy. Next picture down is a composite. On the left, there's Hardagen on the bridge of his boat. On the right, there's Hardagen, almost 100 years old.
Yeah.
He's in pretty good shape.
Yeah, he is.
I talked to him on the phone, about a year ago, and he sounded fantastic. And he said, but he doesn't play golf quite so much anymore. He was coming on 99 at that time.
Huh.
He had a lot of golf trophies in his house.
Wow. Okay, now we're to Eric Topp.
Mm-hmm.
Shark Hunters member number 118.
Okay. Right. He joined in 1985. He was the third highest scoring submarine commander of any war or any Navy. And he sank the first U.S. Navy warship, the USS Reuben James, in error. This is one of the 50... this is a force tacker like the 50 destroyers we gave to England.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw it 31st of October 1941. It was in the middle of the night. It was a stormy night. And all he saw was a force tacker escorting a British convoy. And he figured it was one of the ones that we had given England. And he sank it. And it was only after the SOS call came out that he realized it was an American submarine. And he not only was absolutely ashamed, these guys had incredible honor. He was ashamed that he had sunk a ship of a country with which they were not officially at war.
Mm-hmm.
And he also thought he was going to get shot when he got home because the U-boat skippers were under strict orders. They were not to engage American units at all because he knew Roosevelt was trying to provoke a war.
Yeah.
Fortunately for Topp, by the time he got back to the base, Pearl Harbor had happened.
Uh-huh.
And they had a much better reason to go to war.
Yeah.
Very good. All right. Two very nice pictures of him. One on the right holding a bouquet of tulips.
Yeah, he had just come back from a patrol, and, you know, they always got the flowers, and the bands were there, and the girls were there.
Yeah.
The one on the left was his formal photo after receiving the swords to his Knight's Cross with oak leaf, and only five U-boat skippers were so decorated. Out of over 1,000 skippers, only five got that award.
Wow. Wow.
And he was the third most successful of all.
Okay. All right. Next.
Next, you see Topp. There are two guys talking. Topp was on the left. I don't know who that is on the right, but apparently he had just come off patrol. The one on the right was in 1998. There was a military show out in San Francisco, and that was our booth out there, and he was a guest in our booth. That's me on the left, Topp in the center, and I forget the fella on the right. That's our backdrop there.
Very good. All right. Now, here's a picture of him actually, apparently, periscope up looking.
Yeah. This is the funny story. Like I said, these guys were looked on as rock stars back in those days. And here's a picture of him with his arms draped over the limbs of the periscope. And he got they used to get fan mail, hundreds and hundreds of letters. And he got a letter from a young lady in Germany who had included her photo, and he said she was a beautiful young lady, and with this picture of him with his arm draped over the periscope and his eye up to the ocular,
mm-hmm.
and the girl said, I would like to be your periscope. You can fill in the blanks from there, Jeff.
How nice. Yeah.
He was a nice man. He was a very nice man, and I was in his home, I don't know how many times in Europe.
Uh-huh.
He came over here to our convention in 2000, and I said, I got him a nice room in the hotel in Daytona, and he said he has a nurse who travels with him.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay, we'll get you a room next to yours for your nurse.
Mm-hmm.
No, Harry, she must be in my room. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. So we got him the penthouse suite, mm-hmm. and I went to pick him up at the airport. He was 83, and his nurse was 23, a very attractive young Korean 23-year-old girl. So I told my wife, and I said, you know, when I'm 83, I want a nurse like that. My wife says, you keep talking like that, you ain't going to make it to 83.
You won't make it to 83.
He was just a wonderful, wonderful gentleman, always had a bow tie, and anybody who can tie their own bow tie, in my opinion, is very classy.
All right. Okay, another picture on the left, and there's a picture on the right with Adolf Hitler, apparently.
Right. That's correct. On the left, that's Top talking to his flotilla commander. Mm-hmm. He's got his cigarette. On the right, that's him shaking hands with Hitler. This is on receipt of his Knight's Cross with Oak Leaf. The guy in the center, I believe, is Walter Tunigas, who was an S-boat commander. He was also getting his Oak Leaf at the time.
All right. Picture of Top on board, keeping his log, it looks like.
That's correct. And the tour has been for quite a while because he's got quite a beard growing.
All right.
Next one down, he's on the bridge of his boat with, he's the guy in the white top.
Yep.
And that's his, probably his Obersteuerman, the navigating officer that he's mm-hmm. talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And the lookouts are all looking at the camera, so they're obviously not in a heavy combat zone.
I would say.
All
right. Next picture, he's all in whites.
Right. That's the summer white. And this was early on because you notice he's got only a Knight's Cross. This was early on. He hadn't gotten the other two decorations.
Yeah. And very good. Okay. Nice uniforms.
Yeah.
All right. The next picture, three captains.
Right. That's Top on the far right.
Mm-hmm.
And the other two, without looking at it, I don't know. But I think the one in the middle, I think, is Engelbert Endras, but I'm not positive.
I think he has oak sleeves.
That's correct. And Endras and Top were best friends. And Top was devastated when Endras was lost.
Yeah. Okay, very good. And the last picture?
The last picture, we surprised Eric. His house had been burglarized. Somebody broke in and stole his Knight's Cross with oak leaf and sword.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, and they stole his honors dagger. Only 6 honors daggers in the world, and they stole his. And so he donated all the rest of his stuff to the Bavarian Army Museum, and they had a big ceremony, mm-hmm. and he didn't know that we knew, and he's up there making a speech, and suddenly we popped in, and he was just, oh, Harry, the shark hunters are here, and he was just mm-hmm. so happy that we were there for this occasion.
Nice.
He was a fine, fine gentleman.
Well, there's that bow tie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you never saw him without his bow tie. Even when he was in Daytona, and I had to bring something to his room. I knocked on the door, 8:00 in the morning, in a suit with a bow tie.
Wow. All right. Very, very interesting tour. Fascinating picture tour.
Yeah, you'll notice in that picture, he has a big dent in his head.
Oh,
you
yeah,
see
I see that. Yep.
After his wife had passed away, he had a girlfriend, and they were by his home in Spain. He and Kretschmer and some of the other guys had winter homes in Spain. He was driving along, and somebody T-boned his car, broke his femur, which is a horrible break for anybody, but he was like in his 80s at the time, and also mm-hmm. whacked him in the head. They had to operate, mm-hmm. and it killed his girlfriend.
Mm.
So that's the dent in his head.
Well, all right. I mean, just remarkable things to think about. A whole piece of history, just a tiny little fragmentary glimpse of it, courtesy of Harry Cooper and Shark Hunters. All right, Harry, we don't have a lot of time left, about maybe 9 minutes. Let's go back to that issue of Hitler getting out of Berlin and escaping to South America.
Right.
People say, no, he was shot, they burned his body. No, the word is, that was they always used doubles or triples, and that was probably a double if there was a body that was burned.
Well, everybody, all the leading people had doubles. When there was one time when people could see Roosevelt in the Rose Garden, but he really wasn't there. He was over at Yalta.
Amazing.
Meeting
True.
With Stalin. Stalin had doubles. They all did.
Yeah. So not a hard issue. Now, Hannah Hannah Reich flew into Germany, into Berlin, landed on the street, tried to get Hitler to leave. He said, no, I'm not leaving.
Right.
That's the story.
That's correct. She flew out with an officer, Robert Ritter von Greim. Ritter means knight.
Mm-hmm.
And she was flying just a two-seater Storch,
mm-hmm.
a Stork.
Mm-hmm.
And it could only carry two people. So that was her and von Greim. And he got injured in ground fire as they were taking off. And he later committed suicide. So she did not fly out with Hitler at that point.
Mm-hmm.
The story was told to us by one of our members who was working for the SSSD, the Sicherheitsdienst of the SS, and he was in the bunker. He was stationed in the bunker, and he saw Hitler physically drugged and removed by orders of Martin Bormann, the same with Eva Braun. Hitler was a broken man. He was ready to die, but Bormann wanted to keep the Reich alive, which he did, from South America, and he needed Hitler as a figurehead. He was taken out from Berlin to Spain. We don't quite have that movement, but from Spain down, there was what the Allies called the rat line from Spain down to Argentina. Hundreds, maybe even thousands, escaped that way. He was one of them. They had black boats, submarines, and they had tramp steamers, and they even had some 90-ton sailing boats that came out of a place called Villa Garcia, which was up the river from Vigo, Spain, which,
mm-hmm.
you know, they always, if you saw a Das boat, you know, they always had a ship stuck in there. And as I mentioned last time, there was an island about 1,000 kilometers off Rio de Janeiro, which nobody ever heard of, called Trindade, not to be confused with Trinidad, and it's a rock about 2.5 miles long by 1.5 miles wide, and it goes up to 3,000 feet. And there's fresh water, plenty of fresh water. I was there in 2010. You can only go there with the help of the Brazilian Navy, and they were absolutely wonderful. They took me out on one of their ships, put me up in their quarters out there, wonderful people. And there are streams and creeks and ponds, good, clean, fresh water all over the island. And they had herds of pigs and goats and sea turtles on the island. And there was a small German contingent there until 1947, 2 years after the war ended, to oversee all these assets. And then finally they left and the Brazilian Navy came back. There's also, if you look on our website and click on previous tours and click on Brazil, there's a huge cavern or tunnel or whatever you want to call it at the southeastern end of this island. It is big enough to put ships in there, and it goes through the island. This was not man-made. God did it over the millions of years, but it was like, I think it's 40 meters high above the water and 15 meters deep. We still haven't figured out what that was used for.
Submarines could transit that. Boats could transit that.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. And I wanted to go see that tunnel, but I didn't have a small boat to be able to go around there, and the path to it went right along the side of the cliff, came right down to the water, and then there was about a 3-foot-wide path
went
for like 1/4 mile.
Yeah.
But the sea was running real heavy, and there were huge waves crashing over this.
Uh-huh.
And there's just no way.
Yeah. Well, fascinating. All right, so in your estimation, and you probably have things that you would never disclose to me or this program, you have in your world no question that he was removed, obviously against his will. Perhaps a double was shot and buried or burned, not buried, but burned in that pit.
Right.
And that's the story, but you don't have any doubt that he got out.
Have no doubt whatsoever. I was in the town where his estate was. I was there in 2008 and 2009. It's a little Bavarian-looking village at the foothills of the Andes. I don't speak Spanish, but I got along fine with my German. People greet each other on the street with their arm in the air, and There was an SS officer there that Sam Donaldson outed back in 1995. And I spoke to people who knew Hitler. As a matter of fact, one guy who was a boat captain, we rented a small boat to go to his estate in 2009. You could only get there by water. And this guy started goose-stepping across the grass with his right arm in the air, and I asked him, what the hell are you doing? And he said, I know who lived here. And I asked him, how do you know? And he said, I grew up here. My father was the caretaker. And he put his finger underneath his nose and put it like a mustache and put his right arm in the air, and he said, I know who lived here because I knew him.
Wow. I wonder if there are any photographs. It must be.
I haven't been able to find any, but we've got tons of FBI files from 1945, all stating they knew he got out. Stalin mm-hmm. knew he got out. Stalin mm-hmm. was screaming at the Allies in July of 45, mm-hmm. 3 months after the alleged suicide. He was screaming that the Allies, Brits and America especially, were not doing enough to find Hitler. Well, if you got his body from April, why are you looking for him in July? There's just no question he got out.
Right.
And anybody who still believes that story about the death in the Fuhrer bunker is probably putting out cookies and milk on Christmas Eve.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it makes sense. The idea of him being drugged and removed by Bormann also makes sense. That's interesting.
Yeah, Bormann was alive and running the Nazi International, I think some people call it, well into the 1960s
mm-hmm.
from Buenos Aires.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw the hotel where he lived the first couple of years. He lived in a suite with two young women. You mm-hmm. can't fault him for that.
No, that's kind of one of the perks of having been on the top, I guess.
And having access to hundreds of billions of dollars.
That too.
And we believe that he helped finance Juan Perón's ascendancy to the presidency, because Juan Perón was only a colonel with no fortune, no land.
One of those overnight leaps into prominence. And
exactly.
Yeah,
suddenly he became a wealthy landowner and president of Argentina.
What do we think ultimately happened to Hitler when he passed? Was he buried down there somewhere? And then...
That's something we don't know, and I'm not sure I would want to know where he was buried, because, you know,
clearly,
people would be pulling my fingernails out to get that information. I don't think I want to do that.
No, I wouldn't even ask you if you did.
I don't. Right. I don't.
I hear you. Harry, this has been just fascinating, and I thank you very, very much for all the work you do and you, to your organization. My best wishes to the men who fought and served in the U-Boat Corps. Congratulations to you, all of you, and your deeds will live as
Thanks.
Long as
it's there
are people
a labor
who
of love.
Care. Yes, of course. All right. Thank you, Harry. We'll talk to you again.
My pleasure, Jeff. Anytime.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
All right, there's a look at World War II that you won't get on talk radio. And again, we honor all soldiers of all sides. Bravery knows no bounds. But these men were exceptional. Seven went out, only one came back out of seven. All right, we'll be back tomorrow night. Talk to you then.